Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast trying not to go off the rails. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, this week, it's Infrastructure Week on the podcast. If Donald Trump's Infrastructure Week is anything to go by, then we'll get sidetracked by either me attacking Sadiq Khan on Twitter or James Comey testifying about Steve's alleged federal crimes. But on this episode, we're going to try and talk about subjects that no other political podcast dares to talk about, like buses. In terms of the debate over infrastructure that's going on at the moment, there's four problems that we've identified that are going on. The first problem is essentially personified by Boris Johnson, as most problems in British politics are, and that is the focus on big grand projects over small incremental improvements. So the impetus for talking about infrastructure was Boris's plan for a bridge. Now, he had a plan for a bridge, Steve, and Mexico was going to pay. No, sorry, that's the other big infrastructure project. A bridge across the channel to link England and France. It's similar to other big infrastructure projects that Boris has thought of. So when he was London Mayor, he talked about having a London Garden Bridge, which I think has now been shelved by Steve Khan.
It has been scrapped.
There was also the plan to have an airport in the river. For some reason, that didn't take off either,
One could say it sank.
Yes, turns out planes can't float. I mean, that's why boats were invented, I suppose. A lot of people have said that the bridge across the channel... Well, Emmanuel Macron said that the bridge was a great idea in the way that if your small child said that a bridge over the water from England to France would be a good idea, you would probably indulge them and say, yes, it would be a very good idea. But actually, Boris isn't the first one who's had the idea of having a bridge across the channel. It was first proposed in the Thatcher government, so 5 years before they built the Channel Tunnel, they talked about having a bridge. Problem is, though, to build a bridge, they needed massive concrete blocks to go in the middle of the sea. And that's a problem, Steve, because there's a lot of ships that travel in the across the channel.
I suppose they can't move through massive concrete blocks, can they?
The technology isn't immediately available to allow ships to travel through concrete. And because the channel is one of the main shipping points in the world, you've got engineers and academics who specialise in this saying it might be easier to move the French coast to England than it would be to build a bridge across the channel. And I suppose the problem is that we end up talking when we talk about transport projects, about big projects like HS2 and this bridge, rather than talking about small things that might actually improve most people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, there was actually, off the back of this discussion about Boris's new channel bridge, one of the local Tory MPs from around Dover, mm-hmm. Charlie Elphick,
yeah,
came out with a load of things like any good constituency MP would do. And he said, well, if we're going to do this, we need to upgrade this road to a dual carriageway. We need to expand this motorway in this way. And we need, here's a whole list and host of smaller infrastructure policies, which we would need to do to actually make this bridge a success, which, by the way, I'm totally in favour of because it will get me all of these things. And that's something that we tend to miss when we are looking and talking about infrastructure in the UK, is we always seem to talk about the big, shiny, latest trend-setting investment, whether that be HS2, Crossrail, this bridge, or maybe even, as I suspect will probably happen, a second channel tunnel. You know, we always talk about those, and we never, ever, ever talk about all the little things that are actually going to make much more of an impact to people's everyday lives. The fact that the people of Dover don't have all of the roads that need to be, you know, dual carriageways, is going to be impacting on their daily lives because it's going to be causing congestion, which is going to be causing problems in air quality, which is going to be causing problems in health. So, actually, by investing in these smaller projects, you can make a significant impact on people's everyday lives. Let's just use Birmingham as an example here. The Bristol Road in Birmingham is one of the most congested roads in the UK just because everybody goes down it. One of the reasons Birmingham's air quality is so bad is because people keep on coming into the city through into the city in cars, which could be resolved with better investment in other forms of infrastructure, such as public transport. But the public debate when it comes to infrastructure is always about these bigger projects, supposedly because they're going to have greater like return on investment. That's probably the case in terms of pure economics. So, you know, you invest X many pounds, you'll get X many pounds plus one back. But in terms of wider impact, that is actually going to benefit people. It's these smaller projects that we would need to focus on. And currently, we're not doing that.
I wonder if it's because, essentially, politicians want a little bit of a ribbon-cutting moment as well. I mean, Isambard Kingdom Brunel built a bridge, and he's famous for building a bridge. And you look at that bridge, and you see, you picture Brunel with a cigar looking over it in a way that you would not do if you had a ribbon-cutting ceremony on the A2 to Dover, which is now a dual carriageway.
Yeah, no, I suspect there probably is an element of that. And again, this kind of links towards some of the other problems, I think, that we do have in our discussions and debate on infrastructure, is that it's all very London-centric. And I think that's probably because an awful lot of the people making the decisions live and spend an awful lot of time in London, and therefore they see the benefits of investing in London infrastructure projects, which, unless they are a local MP for a specific constituency or in a specific region, they're not necessarily going to see the benefit of, you know, upgrading the A2 in any capacity. So, which means, no time or energy gets spent on it.
No, and the fact that we're talking about Crossrail, and in fact now talking about Crossrail 2 in London before a lot of the other public transport and train improvement projects that we're going to talk about later, before they've been developed and approved, I think shows a lot of the bandwidth of transport discussion happens in London, I suppose, as you say, because a lot of MPs spend a lot of time travelling to and from London. And I suppose if the point is you're trying to improve it economically, then maybe trying to have, say, HS2 and have train lines making it 10 minutes quicker from London to Birmingham maybe makes more sense in that respect, but isn't necessarily good for most people in the country. So we've talked about two problems so far, the focus on big crown projects and that London-centric attitude. The third problem is one you've touched on already, and that is that in Britain, it's the focus on the car to the exclusion of other methods of transport. So in London, 45% of people commute by public transport. In the north, it's 75% of people commuting by car. I don't know what the figure is for Birmingham and the West Midlands. I suspect it's nearer 75% than 45% that travel by car. You mentioned Bristol Road. If we can have another obscure Birmingham reference, because we've got out of the habit of mentioning it on the podcast, we're about 15, 20 minutes walk away from Kingsheath High Street, which was the subject of a BBC documentary about air quality. I believe it was a Panorama investigation that aired a couple of weeks ago. And that's because the street is full of cars, so it's full of diesel, it's full of pollution. For all that we talk about, or a lot of the tabloid media will talk about the war on motorists, actually the cost of going by car has dropped by 16% over the past few years. Cost of trains has increased by 23%. And the cost of a bus has gone up by a third.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason for that is that various governments, most notably George Osborne, Osborne as Chancellor under the Coalition, have been trying to subsidise road travel. There used to be a tax escalator that would happen on basically the cost of petrol at the pump. It would go up every year or every couple of years, with the aim being that it would hopefully discourage people from actually using cars as much. Maybe they'd take the bus more, help tackle climate change. A reasonably sensible policy. The problem is, it's a very easy political win to be nice to motorists, because a significant number of people who vote motorist and drive in some capacity, and increasing the cost of petrol at the pump when they are when they're filling up the car is going to be very noticeable to them, and it's the sort of thing which it will stand out when it goes up, and therefore it will be one of those issues which a few policies that does cut through in one way or another. Basically, because our political leadership have been a bit timid in that regard recently, we've ended up kowtowing to, in effect, voters who drive rather than investing in public transport.
And it's even more silly when taxing fuel more makes perfect economic sense. If you're going to believe in a free market and believe in market economics, you also have to then believe in negative externalities. And driving by car imposes a pollution cost, imposes that social cost, which is not accounted for in the normal price of fuel unless it's taxed by the government.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the high figures of people in the north who commute by car, and part of that is because there isn't enough infrastructure in northern public transport. So because it's far too slow, say, to commute from Manchester to Sheffield, which should be eminently commutable, really, by train. But at the moment, there isn't really a direct train. It's far too slow. And in fact, there's a body that's just been set up, I think, as part of the Northern Powerhouse stuff called Transport for the North. And that's trying to link Bradford with Manchester, Leeds, Liverpool, these major cities. Because Bradford, I think, is one of the youngest cities in the UK. Quarter of the population is under the age of 25. Well, at the moment, their two train stations are dead ends. They don't go anywhere. So it's an eminently sensible policy to try and link that place with a few of the other major cities.
Perhaps the shocking thing, though, is that even within cities that aren't London, you can see that there are problems with a lack of investment and lack of joined-up thinking in terms of how to get around them when it comes to public transport. Again, going back to the obscure Birmingham references, there are a number of train stations and things which were closed down in the past. I can't exactly remember. Yeah, which could be opened up again. The lines are still there. You could run trains across them, which would make commuting across the city, you know, from one side to the other, basically moving from east to west rather than north to south, which is relatively easy to do. You know, you could invest in that and make it possible to get from, you know, from Edgbaston to Moseley a hell of a lot easier. But we don't do that because we're too focused on other things in terms of infrastructure.
Yes. And actually, one of the things in the mayoral campaign is that Andy Street, the Tory candidate for mayor, so the former chairman of John Lewis, not to be confused, obviously, with Andy Street, former chair of Oxford University Conservatives, part of his mayoral campaign was about trying to reopen these stations that I imagine were closed under Beeching, but I'm not entirely sure. A lot of the problem with reopening them is the fact that, certainly politically, maybe there's a few people that would maybe generally quite like it, but probably the few houses that are by a station that would be reopened would probably kick up a lot of fuss, because obviously if you live near it, there's going to be much more noise pollution from the train, probably a lot more traffic congestion, people driving to the station, mm-hmm. A lot more footfall as well. So I can imagine it's one of those things that politically it's quite difficult, because you might not get very many people who will vote for you for that policy, but you know there's going to be a good, solid core group of people who would not vote for you and vote against you if you came up with that proposal.
Yeah, I mean, that is always a risk in any form of infrastructure policy, regardless of the scale of it. And I think maybe that's one reason we do tend to fall back on these bigger, grander ideas, is because, you know, whilst a lot of them, I think, are white elephants, who are you going to annoy, actually, by building a bridge from between France and Britain?
People in ships.
Yes, but those people don't vote.
Sailors.
Most of the people coming through the channel are not British. They actually travel through. It's not just British ships that go up and down it. It's international.
Oh, that's true.
Does it really matter if we annoy some Finnish people in that regard? No, it doesn't. Well, but it does matter to the local MP or to the local council or to the local mayor for the region if you know, Moseley suddenly might vote Labour versus voting Tory because we reopen that train station.
Apologies to our Finnish listeners. We do actually care what you think. Sorry about that. Final problem then of the four, I think, is, and we've sort of done it a little bit on this episode already, is the focus on trains to the exclusion of other methods of public transport. Mm-hmm. So every year, Labour does a little bit of a campaign. I took part of it, took part in one of these myself this year, protesting outside the train station because of the increase of fares. The increase of fares this year gone up way more than inflation. A lot of the focus is on trains. Again, I'm guessing because a lot of MPs will travel by train around their cost, or travel to London by train. A lot of journalists will travel around by train. Don't usually see Laura Koonsberg getting the National Express bus or getting the mega bus out to Brighton or what have you.
Although I would pay money to see that though. But yeah, you are right. I mean, that is a part of it. The other significant part of it is that a number of battleground areas for the Tories and Labour are in the South East of England, and that's the commuter belt. That's actually the area where, as you say, what was it, for the 60-odd percent of people commute into London for work via public transport, and that will be via trains for an awful lot of them. Maybe some of them are going by bus part of the way, but to get into London, really, you're going by train if it's public transport. Because they're trying to win votes in those seats, which are more swingy and more available for people to potentially pick up on both sides, you end up throwing more and more money at London public and South East public transport rather than investing in the North or the Midlands or, heaven forbid, Wales or Scotland.
And actually, an unintended consequence of that investment has been to take a lot of natural Labour voters out of the inner cities who can go to some of the outside outer London boroughs, places like Croydon, which was Gavin Barwell's seat before switching in June. And a lot of those seats, which were quite natural Tory territory, they are now turning red because of that investment. So it's a kind of interesting consequence of that policy. So they're the problems. Let's have a think about some of the solutions, especially looking at this from a Labour point of view, what a Labour government might do. Obviously, in terms of the trains, one of the policies that's been put forward is renationalising the railways. Now, obviously, that is a usually very popular policy among voters when it's polled. We're not really going to talk about it much on this episode, though. Listen to our last episode on outsourcing a Carillion for what we think about public ownership of railways. But if we can sum it up, it's not quite the full solution, is it?
No, I mean, it might go some of the way, but you need to run it in a very particular way to actually make it work.
So Labour's plan for infrastructure in the manifesto, the hallowed manifesto last June, was essentially to borrow to invest, spend a lot of money. And the plan was to do £250 billion of infrastructure spending over 10 years. And a bit of discussion over what this would do to the national debt and all that kind of thing. But what's interesting is that the Office for Budget Responsibility, the kind of independent statisticians of the government, they say there's a multiplier effect of 1.10 in terms of that infrastructure spending. Basically, that means that for every £1 that is invested in infrastructure, GDP would rise by £1.10. For every pound. So it would be a way of growing the economy. So a lot of the debate that ended up happening when John McDonnell was talking about this plan, and something that happened recently, is that people start thinking about, well, what would happen to the national debt? Which in many ways, I feel anyway, is a little bit of a red herring, because if this money is used to increase GDP, that debt as a proportion of GDP will fall, and so that debt becomes less of a problem. Question then is, what would that mean for the economy? Now, the IFS, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, who are kind of the doyens of this kind of thing, they crunched the figures a little bit. What they said was that this spending in infrastructure would increase the productive capacity of the British economy. What they said, though, is that under Labour's plans, as they were in the manifesto, it wouldn't lead to an overall net impact on Britain's productive capacity. The reason they say that is because the other stuff that Labour was going to bring in that manifesto would have a negative effect on productivity. So the three policies they mention are Labour's plan to increase the minimum wage, Labour's plan to increase corporation tax, and Labour's plan to have four bank holidays, four extra bank holidays a year for the different saints' days. And they say that that would lead to a lessening of productive capacity. So in the end, it wouldn't really lead to an increase in productivity for the economy.
No, and I think this is where actually you get to some of the nitty-gritty around what the debate about infrastructure should be. Because clearly what Labour are looking to do is use any potential growth from infrastructure to, drive other policy changes. So, you know, that drop in productivity caused by those three or four policies would be covered by this other infrastructure investment. Now, that seems like a very kind of sensible way to do things. You want to use the economic gains you get from policies to do other stuff, basic kind of balancing act, literally a balance sheet. And what we're not seeing necessarily from the conservative side of this argument is any discussion about what this investment should be for, other than to potentially win votes in these targeted areas. And I think that's something that until we start seeing a bit more of a focused debate from the right on what infrastructure should look like and what it should be trying to do, they're going to end up on the losing side of that argument.
Well, quite. I mean, the IFS are focused on the economic side of it, as you might expect, because they study
economics.
Clues in the name, folks. There are very good reasons, and I would say very compelling reasons, to raise the minimum wage, to raise corporation tax, even to have more bank holidays. I mean, we're having a bit of an argument and went before the show that maybe you thought a better way of changing the balance of work would be to increase the statutory holiday pay.
Yeah, basically, for instance, if you were going to bring in like more days off, let's actually make it so they're ones that people can choose when they're taken off, because all of the Saints' days fall on the same kind of time where all the other bank holidays are. You know, having another bank holiday in and around Easter, it doesn't serve anybody particularly well. Giving everybody one or two extra days statutory holiday that they can take and use as in whatever way they want, will actually potentially help, you know, make work a little better for a lot of people.
And raising corporation tax to what would still be below the average in Europe makes sense. We can have a debate. Certainly raising the minimum wage also makes sense. We can have a bit of a debate on what the effect would be on jobs and what have you, but change the nature of work. Like there's nothing wrong with those policies, even though they make the economy less productive, just as no one's proposing we make the economy more productive by abolishing the weekend. I think you're right in that the question is, what are we going to use this infrastructure for? And what we're going to use that spending for? Because infrastructure, as we've kind of hinted, part of it is an environmental problem with CO2 emissions. It's also a health problem as well. You know, in Birmingham, 1,000 people die of bad air quality every year. As someone who suffers from asthma, it's something I think quite personally about. Like that is an important part of infrastructure as well, which might not be measured in the GDP figure, but it's surely a really compelling reason to invest in it. There's the mental health side as well. If you're spending 2 hours of your day in which you are commuting and you're in a car and you're getting stressed, well, that is going to have a negative impact on your mental health, because if you're working 9 to 5, but it takes an hour to get to work, well, that's even more time you're spending out of the house.
Yeah, and again, one of the things, as we've kind of laid out on today, is that the externalities of a lot of the kind of decisions that are made on infrastructure don't take the full range into account. We seem to just focus almost solely on that economic aspect of it. And yeah, because London is such a massive part of the British economy, it means that London gets more and more money. When the reality is that in order to solve multiple problems, we need to invest in infrastructure across Britain, it may not deliver as significant an ROI on return on the investment, but it will help solve other problems, which will, you know, help free up resources in other areas. If we've got fewer people having breathing difficulties, that frees up money from the NHS to be used on other things.
And it goes back to a little bit of what we were saying in the programme on outsourcing last week. The programme, what, like we're kind of David Attenborough or something. But it's the... And I've forgotten the point I was going to make. It's that professional. It's the... So it's the fact that you need to plan this stuff. It's the fact that you need to have a long-term vision, a long-term plan of what you're going to do. And ironically, one of the things that it looked like Theresa May was going to do, one of the ways in which she was going to try and make do politics a little differently than a lot of her Conservative predecessors, was by having some sort of industrial policy, an industrial strategy, in a kind of very Ed Miliband kind of way. I think it's one of those things that Nick Timothy was very big on, and the fact that essentially they flunked the election and flunked the result means I don't know if you will see from the right that kind of infrastructure policy coming along. Essentially, I almost think it's been discredited by association.
Yeah, and there's also the fact that since the election, the Conservatives have fallen back onto those, the old arguments around, oh, Labour's going to damage the economy, we are the only people who can be trusted to run the economy. And that's all based around the notion of debt and deficit, which you can't make those arguments and invest in infrastructure to the degree that we would actually need to make a significant impact. So the fact that they're falling back on those arguments means that they're not going to be able to, coherently at least, make the case in any form, even though it would be both economically politically a good move.
Politically, it would be good for them to take off the austerity straitjacket, but you're right in saying that it's the only narrative they've got in town at the moment. And I think if we're looking at dividing lines between Labour and the Tories at the next election, certainly one of them will be this thought, essentially, that a Corbyn government would bankrupt the economy. And I'm sure that that £250 billion figure in infrastructure would be part of that. I think the challenge for Labour is going to be trying to make the case for that investment, while a lot of the public are still believing that kind of narrative on austerity and the deficit. We've seen John McDonnell in interviews get quite tetchy when he's asked about, well, how are you going to pay for this? Is it going to add to the national debt? He's being quite spirited in saying, well, it will pay for itself and there is this multiplier. I think it will be more difficult than we realise to, after, you know, 7 or when we get to an election, probably a good 10 years of that austerity rhetoric. It's going to be difficult for Labour to make that case, I think.
Potentially, but at the same time, people, as demonstrated by the 2017 general election result, or significant amounts of people, are tired of austerity and they're tired of that rhetoric. And if you can go in with a programme which says, actually, here's a list of things which we're going to upgrade or work on in your area, you know, that's a very good message to send and a very good strong message to actually persuade people to vote. So it could go either way. My gut instinct at the moment says actually you're more likely to lean towards Labour's position by the time of the next election.
Shall we finish for the second week in a row on a note of optimism?
I don't like this. No, this is unusual.
Shall we talk about Brexit next week? And then all the optimism will go when we realise we can't do anything because we don't have any money, because even the best case scenario, we've lost 2% of GDP.
There it is. That's how we should end. Right. On the normal key.
Thank heavens for that. I was worried for a second. If you want to see more of our optimistic doom mongering, then you can see our website, notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. We haven't asked you to do so in a while, but if you do like our show, if you can rate our show on iTunes, that's very nice. It helps people discover it. If you can subscribe there as well, that also helps. My personal Twitter handle is @papermattwriter.
And mine is @centreradical.
Happy plotting, everyone.